Good morning. Thank you for coming. My name is Jim Lewis. Welcome to CSIS. This is a joint event between CSIS and ASTRA, and we're very happy today to have a very distinguished panel, which I always say, but in this case happens to be true, a very distinguished panel to talk about something that has been interesting to me for a few years here now, and I'm sure for the rest of you too. We're generally in the throes of kind of a slow-moving notion that the U.S. is in a crisis of competitiveness, and this is not the first time we've confronted this kind of issue. My favorite quote is from President Eisenhower's science advisor, who said that because the U.S. was lagging behind in science and math education, that we were doomed to fall into second place and to be supplanted by the Soviet Union. So he got that one wrong, and the question is, have we lucked out? How are things different? What are we doing now to meet the new competitiveness challenges, which are very real? We put a fact sheet out on your chairs, on some of your chairs, and it'll be on our website if you didn't get one. But when you look at the numbers, we are stronger than we were in science and technology. We are stronger than we were when Sputnik was first launched, and that little beeping noise you heard with Sputnik. The problem isn't that, you know, whether we're strong or weak or whether we're growing or not growing. The problem is that other people have looked at what we've done and they are growing faster. So we do face a competitiveness challenge, and the issue is, how will we respond to it? Will we respond the way we responded in 1957, when a little beeping noise sort of woke everyone up? The panel today will talk about that. There's some good things happening and we'll hear about them, but there's still some real challenges. The moderator for today's event and the first speaker is Dr. Mary Good. And the thing that impressed me in her bio was that she managed to get her PhD in inorganic chemistry at age 24. And if any of you have gotten a doctorate, you know how amazing that is. So that's very impressive. But that's just the first of many impressive accomplishments. She is, of course, the chairwoman of ASTRA, which is one of the reasons we have her here today, a distinguished scientist, someone who's been very influential in the Washington policy community. So a great person to open the event and to take us through. Mary.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, let me say that we really do thank you all for letting us have this meeting here at CSIS. This is a great location, and we appreciate the hospitality, amongst other things, because ASTRA, as some of you know, is one of those shoestring operations that we manage to keep going by the generosity of a lot of people and a lot of people who actually give of their time and effort to make these things work out. But today, we really do have an extraordinarily interesting discussion to have with all of you, and we're just delighted with the response that we've got of the people who are coming. And I'm not going to take up very much of your time, because we really do have some extraordinary people on this panel today who are going to talk to you. But I would like to just sort of set it in context, if I might. The Sputnik, when it went up, and in fact we've been asked by a couple of people as to why would we have a celebration on the day of Sputnik? Why didn't we have one on the day that the United States launched its first satellite? Well, it's my view that the reason for doing that is that Sputnik itself is what drove a lot of issues, and it really was a turning point in the United States, because in many ways it was the first time the United States had been challenged in a scientific way since the end of the Second World War. And all of a sudden, we found out that we were not the only people left in the world who knew something about technology, and particularly high technology as it was defined. So it really did spark a lot of angst in the United States with that little beeping thing that you just heard. And then, of course, Dr. Hertzberg will tell you a little bit about the surroundings of that, which is just wonderful in terms of, we have a person here who actually was sort of a participant in it. So it's going to be an insight into how that all happened. But at any rate, the response from the United States was several-fold. If you'll remember, the president, President Kennedy, one of the most dramatic speeches he ever made was about the fact that we will put a person on the moon. The Russians had put up, first of all, just a satellite, and then they'd put up one with a dog aboard. And he said, we will be the first people to put a man on the moon. And this really drove a lot of things. It excited a lot of kids. We started a lot of new educational programs, and it really began to, if you like, impact the United States with respect to where we were in the world. Since that time, one of our issues in the United States is with respect to trying to keep our science and technology at a really high level, we've not been able to identify another Sputnik. We've not been able to identify another man on the moon kind of effort that would actually get everybody energized and everybody moving. That's been a difficult thing to do. We've done a lot of really important science since then, and a big string of technology successes, but we've never found, if you like, a new Sputnik to excite the public like that one did. The first site, the next, if you like, review in the United States where we actually made some major changes was what was perceived to be the threat of Japan when it began to truly move and became a really major competitor, particularly in manufactured goods. Those of you who remember, the American automobile companies were highly challenged by the Japanese because the Japanese got to the point where they were putting out better cars, better made, and their manufacturing technology was highly superior. So the United States passed some Competitiveness Act agenda at that time, which really changed the way people behaved. We put in things like the Manufacturing Extension Program, all kinds of things to raise the awareness that we really did need to improve the quality of our products. And in fact, if you like, you might think that the response to that Japanese threat was a move to quality in the United States. There was enormous effort put into quality by the companies, pushed by government, pushed by lots of people, and indeed we were able at that time to manage to stay in the game. Within a few years, the automobile products from the United States were at least in quality as good as those from Japan. We're now back to that situation in a way, and in a sense, the current piece on our American automobile manufacturers is not so much on quality as it is on how to market what they have and market aggressively against what is now a worldwide market rather than just a U.S. market as it truly pretty much was in those days. So we're now faced with what is known as a new world order. Everybody has heard of, and if they have not read it, in fact, you won't find anybody that you talk to who will admit they have not read A World is Flat. Whether they have read it all or not remains to be seen, but most people will at least will tell you that indeed they have read that book. What it does is simply point out the globalization of the world and the fact that things are now really, at least business and the economy, is a worldwide event, not just a nation-to-nation kind of activity. And last week, the National Academy, through the STEP Board, put on a really interesting conference. I don't know if any of you all were there, called the Dragon and the Elephant, which was one of the most instructional things I have ever sat through because it really laid out in terms that everybody could understand the interconnectedness of the economic pieces of the world, our businesses, and indeed the issue is how are the governments and national governments going to respond to that sort of connectedness around the world. But I was very impressed with the fact that it is clear listening to these people, and these were people that are sort of on the ground, so it was people who really understood what was happening rather than just policy people only talking. And if you listen to that, what you heard was that you now have, instead of having a manufacturing plant for aircraft or automobiles where they had their own suppliers and they had those made and they did their own thing, that process now is essentially scattered all over the world. There's parts being procured from goodness knows where. There's parts being then put together. The assembly can be essentially any place you like. And almost none of those products today are manufactured in any one place. They're manufactured in several places and then assembled, for the most part, where you want them to be sold. It's a very interesting thing. And in that milieu, it was really interesting to listen to the Indians. The Indians are clearly very, very far ahead of most of their competitors in all of the IT areas. They've really pushed that, put a lot of effort into it. They are not ahead in manufacturing, and in fact, their manufacturing base is still really pretty primitive, and they are not very competitive with respect to manufacturing. The Chinese, on the other hand, are far behind the Indians in respect to IT, but they are far ahead of them in manufacturing. So you've got two burgeoning economies which still are being discussed as developing countries, and it's my opinion at some point we need to quit calling them developing countries, because they are getting to the point where they're pretty developed, in my point of view. And if you listen to that in terms of how nations would interact, and one of the questions that came up in this meeting, which I think is one that we all have to wrestle with and try to decide what to do, and that is that the businesses are doing business around the world in the best way they know how to provide revenue for their stockholders and quality products to their customers. That's their allegiance. The question then is, what do we mean by national policies, and how do they interact with that globalization, if you like, of all of these other things that are going on? And to give you an idea of how global that is today, they gave us one example. There was a company here in the United States that outsourced a lot of IT kind of work to the Indians. To an Indian company, and that company then outsourced a lot of it to India. But the Indians didn't have enough people to do it all, so they outsourced a significant piece of it back to the United States. I mean, this is how intertwined these things are becoming. And the Indian issue is really interesting because, first of all, the low wage issue there is going to very rapidly disappear, because their wage rates are going up by 15 to 20% a year. They're going to be fairly quickly, in terms of buying cheap labor of the kind you want there, is not going to happen. The second problem, which they, some of their government ministers and so forth admit, is they've essentially used up all of their people from the IITs, the quality people that everybody went for at a good price. So now they've got to figure out, how do they create more of those people, and how do you do that rapidly? And as everybody knows in this room, you do not create new IITs overnight. These were built over the last 50 to 100 years, if you like. So how do you get more people and with the quality that you would like to have? So they have serious problems, and because of this sort of shortage, a company there today pays much better wages than they did 2 or 3 years ago. And secondly, their turnover rate is very high because there are lots of opportunities. So the turnover is something like 20 to 30%. So when you look at that, you say, well, okay, we ought to be able to figure out a way for us to be competitive with part of that. The Chinese, on the other hand, with their manufacturing, and their wage rates are still very low, particularly in manufacturing. So it's going to be quite a while, I think, before you see this kind of wage differential building up in China. But it is growing, and it is not as cheap as it used to be, but it's still extraordinarily inexpensive compared to what we pay for manufacturing in the United States. So all of those are the kinds of issues that are on the table. And so the question that you have is, what do we do in the United States to try to remain as competitive as we would like? And there are some factors and some numbers out there that are not as promising as we might like, because we've lost a lot of the high-wage manufacturing jobs, although with a little bit of ingenuity, we ought to be able to save a fair amount of the high-technology ones, which we're actually doing. We're seeing people move to the United States to do some of their manufacturing. For example, Little Rock, Arkansas, in the last 3 months, has added two new manufacturers of significant products, both of them fairly high-technology products. One of them is a Danish company building windmill blades for the energy industry, and the second is an Indian company building specialized pipe for the particularly natural gas exploration people. So we still have an ability to bring people here. So what should be the kinds of government policies that you put in place to make this thing to be to the point where our children can enjoy the same standard of living as those of us in this room were able to acquire? So the issue is, what has been the response? Well, we've had a couple, and one of them is a huge breakthrough, which was the America Competes Act, as most of you know, which was signed here about a month ago. Now, the only problem with the America Competes Act, and I don't want anybody in the audience to go home believing that the president signing the America Competes Act fixed the problem, because, number one, it was an authorization, not not an appropriation. There was not a nickel in that bill. This means it's really easy to make a big deal about that, because that's not where this will get off the ground. The next issue is to try to get an appropriation that then approximates what one would like, that what was said in that bill is now to get money behind it, which we will have to work on in the next little while. And one of the efforts that ASTRA will be undertaking in these next few months is how to get the people organized to try to get an appropriation that actually equals the promise of the authorization. So today, we're going to take the time to have a little bit of a look back, see where we have been, where we've come, and also to try to look forward. History is very important, and one should read it and understand it, but one should also understand that the response that we made at the end of the 50s about Sputnik was not a sufficient one in the 80s when we responded against the Japanese, and that will not be the right nor adequate one to respond to the current process. These things require imaginative new solutions, because the situation has changed so dramatically since 1980 that even though the history gives us some guidance, it will not tell us what to do, because you've got to be able to be imaginative and look forward. And so that's one of the things we're going to talk about today, is both the history, where we are, and where we'd like to be. And what I'd like to do is to introduce our speakers, and I think you will find these are really exciting people today. The first speaker is Dr. Charles Hertzfeld, which I suspect most people in the audience know, and I'll not read the lovely piece that he has in the book that you all have. You'll get some excitement out of what he has there. But he also represents a group that I think we need to also remember. He was born in Vienna, Austria. And if we look at the contribution that immigrants have made to our technical base, if anybody represents it appropriately, Dr. Hertzfeld does. We need to keep that in mind when we try to tackle the immigration issues that we have today, particularly for PhD scientists, which, as many of you know, is a real hassle. But his PhD, and he fits the bowl all across the board, because his PhD is from the University of Chicago. And we have a lot of those students in the country today. But he started as the director of ARPA, was a director in 1965, and so was one of those people that was trying to figure out what to do about this Sputnik thing. He also has been involved with ITT, defense, space, energy, corporate VP for technology at ITT, director of the Defense Research and Engineering Program under Bush 1, which is where I got to know him reasonably well. And he was in the White House, OSTP, with Alan Bromley, which many of you remember as a person who truly started the idea of a technology policy, which had really never been done before. And he's now on the Board of Regents for the Potomac Institute for Policy Studies. So we are just delighted to have him with us today, and he's going to be able to give you some really interesting background. And if you don't mind, I think what I'll do is introduce everybody else, and then we'll be able to have some questions at the end and have time for that. The next one that I'd like to introduce is James Turner. Jim Turner, I've known Jim Turner for a long time. He actually quit Congress once and came to work for a company that I worked for, which was kind of interesting. So I got to know him from that thing. But he decided in a few years that he really liked the Congress better and went back. But he is the chief counsel of the Committee on Science and Technology. He's been with that committee for a very long time, and many of us believe he is one of the real friends to the science and technology community and the Congress. And as you all most know, staff mean a lot when you are trying to get something done, because they are the people who actually get these things put together. So he has 29 years of experience as a congressional staff member. I don't think there are very many of those people left with that kind of a background and intuition about what has happened and where we're going. But he graduated from Georgetown and Yale and Westminster College, and he was a member of the Clinton Presidential Transition Team for the Department of Commerce. So he has a lot of background that's going to be of interest to us. He's a trustee of ASTM International and the University of Virginia's Engineering School, which I particularly would like to tune into every once in a while to see what he's doing with that. And next to him is a person that many of us are, those of us who are chemists, and we did point out that this panel is sort of overwhelmingly full of chemists of one kind or another. But Dr. Susan Butts is the Senior Director for External Science and Technology Programs for the Dow Chemical Company. And many of you know that the Dow Chemical Company these days is, I don't remember, it's now the largest or the second largest chemical company in the world. And is essentially very globally dispersed, as Susan knows better than anyone. And Susan has risen through the ranks at Dow Chemical and is one of those people who the chemical community relies on for advice. She's been very active in providing insight into the American Chemical Society on issues that were of importance. She helped write the 2020 vision for the chemical industry. So she's been just an indispensable participant for us in those areas. So I think you're going to hear from her in a way that's really interesting, because she is one of those people that interacts with the universities all the time. And she's going to tell you about some of the issues associated with doing that today. And the last is Bill Bonvillian, which almost all of you know. He will be here. He's going to be a little bit late. His new job is director of the Washington office for MIT. He had been in the Congress for a very long time. He had been the senior staff person for Senator Lieberman from Connecticut, right? And had been there for a very long time. And he had handled essentially all of the legislative issues that surround the technology policy in the Congress. He was one of those people who, if you really needed to get some insight into where the Congress was, particularly over on the Senate side, this was the go-to person. And those of us, we applaud MIT for their good insight in getting him on their staff, but there are those of us who need things every once in a while from the Senate side of the Congress. We really wish Bill was still there so you could go get him to run the traps for you to find out what's going on. But he was also before that at a fairly large law firm, but he has been in that congressional office for a very long time. So I think you're going to be very interested in hearing where he comes from today and what he thinks. And, of course, now his view is now kind of mixed, because he used to represent the Congress. He now represents one of those ugly universities that petitions the Congress. So it's going to be interesting to see how that comes out in a way. So with that, I'm going to turn the program over. We're going to try to run this in a way that sort of gives you the history, if you like, and then allows us to look at some of the things that come after that. And our first speaker will be Dr. Hirschfeld, who's going to talk about a little bit of the history and anything else he likes to.
Thank you, Mary. It's very good to be under your leadership again, as we've done this act before. I would like to thank ASTRA and CSIS for having this. It's an absolutely wonderful idea and wonderful occasion. My direct involvement with Sputnik began actually before Sputnik, but I was the Bureau of Standards. I was in charge of temperature standards for the whole country, and there was no way to measure very high temperatures accurately. You need to do that to build and test reentry shields, either for satellites, manned satellites, or for ballistic missiles. So we did something that we thought was good, and that's another meeting, different audience. But I remember when in the first manned suborbital flight, we had the reentry. We were all sitting in my office praying that this would work as it reentered, because it was the first time with that big an object. I'd like to very quickly talk about the four Sputniks, really, and you have this on here. And I'll scroll it down. There's the Sputnik, and that's important. There's Pearl Harbor, which was a Sputnik-like experience. A Sputnik-like experience is something that changes everybody's thinking, just for shorthand. There was 9/11, and that sure did that. And then there's the next one. And what I want to do is, I'll scroll this down for you as we go, if I can arrange the mouse properly. No, not in that room. There we go. I know how to do this, actually. For each of these, very briefly, I want to talk about how they happened and what could happen, what kind of surprise it was. It was technical, political, or military, and what was the U.S. reaction, and what impact did it have and will it have? And I want to run through these very quickly. The first Sputnik is, of course, the one that we want to... Oh, yeah, I see what I did. Now that won't work. Tell you what. Well, it's either scroll or hear me. I don't know which you prefer. We had a Cold War, Sputnik. There's a great deal of secrecy on both sides, and that in part was why people didn't understand how all this could happen. We knew there was a large American program, and we knew there was a large Soviet program, but and the ballistic missiles really drove the space program. It's not the way people think. The space program was not done for the space program. It was done for ballistic missiles and for reconnaissance satellites, and that's just the fact. And one just has to live with that, like it or no. There's a huge reaction. President Eisenhower was very important in this. And by the way, he really showed his stuff at the time. And Jim Killian, who, as it happened, was president of MIT before, became his science advisor and was enormously influential in how all that went. And so we see the fine hand of MIT. And when you ask, how did Eisenhower know Killian? Well, Eisenhower was president of Columbia, and Killian was president of MIT. As you know, university presidents have a private club, and they talk to each other. And it seems that they two really hit it off on national security and other educational issues. And that's that connection is terribly important for the history. There was a huge reaction. ARPA and NASA were formed. The space program and missile program were totally reorganized. And it's clear that not much got started when NASA or ARPA got started, because the program was running, but they reorganized the space program completely. And the management improved vastly, and priorities were set correctly, and funding was made adequate, and so on. And that's why the successful launch of an American satellite happened fairly soon after Sputnik 1. The Russian and other language programs were devised, huge programs with thousands of students, and that really transformed the cultural scene at that time a good deal. And the interstate highway system was started, in part because Eisenhower liked the German highways that enabled the Germans to move troops, and since people were thinking about evacuating cities, if there was a bomber attack with nuclear weapons, you have pretty good roads to get people out of town. One of the important contributions to the competitive... this is really not working well. Let me use this much less desirable device, which is a scroll device. I'm bogging down in mechanics here. Christ. No, I got to do it. It's really stupid. Anyway, great impact on U.S. science and competitiveness, and I would give ourselves an A-plus for that. One very important thing got started through ARPA, and that is something that Mary, I'm sure, will remember, and that's the Interdisciplinary Materials Centers, which designed a new way to do material science by bringing together chemists, mathematicians, physicists, metallurgists, ceramic experts, everybody, into institutes, and eventually 14 were formed at universities, highly competitive. By the way, that was designed not by bureaucrats, but by scientists. The President's Science Advisory Committee had a lot to do with that, and Killian had a lot to do with it, and was run at ARPA and then the AEC through scientific people. So I think that was an A+. Pearl Harbor, let's talk about that briefly, quickly. So it was World War II. U.S. was a neutral. It was pressuring Japan to stop attacking China and to expand into South Asia. the economic sanctions, in particular the oil embargo. We threatened to sell oil to the Japanese, who only had about a month or two of supplies left. And why anybody in America was surprised that they would do something big is hard to understand today in retrospect. The political and military surprises, they're only small technical surprises. One is radar works. That was a total surprise. It worked as well as it ever does. Identification friend and foe is hard. The people who saw the Japanese airplanes thought there were American airplanes coming in. B-17s were expected from the mainland. And Japan made minor improvements in torpedoes. U.S. reaction was total war, a huge buildup of industry and military, those patriotic support. The GI Bill, which meant free college for World War II veterans, was a major, had a major impact on U.S. competitiveness. And again, it made us the dominant world power, and I would give us an A-plus on that one. Again, and that's when the A's stop. 9/11 is next. It was a war by Muslim extremists on the West. There were several precursors, by the way. The Marines in Lebanon in the 80s. The Khobar Tower attack in Saudi Arabia. Two embassies in the USS Cole. Now, interestingly, every one of these precursors was a suicide attack. It did not dawn on anybody in charge that that was the new style. And by God, it is, to all of our sorrow. And it's changed the world hugely. And impact weakened the U.S. in some ways. Confidence is not restored. I give us a B minus for that one. One can argue about that, but I'm not going to. You put your own grade to it. The reason it's not a plain F is that a lot of things got started. In particular, defense against biological attack is vastly superior than it is now, than it has been. And eventually, the reformation of the intelligence community will take hold. And when that happens, that'll be very powerfully an aid. Let's talk about the next Sputnik. I'm always more interested in the future than the past. It could be atomic, could be bio, could be chemistry, or something altogether different. And people are not thinking about that. I personally tried to fund some studies after the coal. It was obvious from what was in the public media that these people were different, and I wanted to study them, did a little bit of that. And I couldn't sell the study. Nobody in the USG was really interested in figuring out what are these people like, what are they likely to do, and so on. It's quite astonishing. The issue of how surprises happen is not much studied. Now, footnote here is sometimes said that ARPA-DARPA was built to avoid surprises. I think that has it backwards. ARPA-DARPA were built to make surprises. And there's all the difference in the world. One is reactive, the other is proactive. And let me tell you, we don't do proactive all that much anymore. And that's bad. So I urge here mainly to get underway, to think about what the next one might be like. I have some ideas. I will not volunteer those. I don't like to give prescriptions to my enemies how to kill me, so that's for a smaller audience. But with this, with this, I thank you.
Mr. Von Villian will be next, and I do have one note that you're next.
Are you going to do questions?
I think we'll do questions after, if that's okay, and that way we'll have more time and I can get integrated with everybody, if that's okay. Yeah.
Good morning. I wanted at the outset to apologize. I'm going to have to not stay till the very end because I had an appointment, follow-up appointment with the surgeon. I couldn't reschedule. But it's a great privilege to be on this panel, and I think it's very. I commend the people who put it together to have Bill Bonvillian, who, as Murray said, was sort of an indispensable technology staffer. But the other thing he has been on Capitol Hill is our biggest expert on DARPA. So it's, I think it, if there's anyone who should pull this whole thing together, then Bill is the right person to do it. You know, I was...
It just shows you what passes for expertise on Capitol Hill.
Well, I was thinking, why am I, sort of, it's the Ross Perot running mate question, why am I here? But because, I was a 10-year-old when Sputnik happened, and in sixth grade, and but if I think about it, yesterday I got out the history of the Committee on Science and Technology that was written by Ken Heckler, who is really, we're extremely fortunate to have him on the committee, because he not only was the historian of the Joint Chiefs of Staff before he was elected, and very senior advisor to President Truman. He also was an award-winning novelist from his experience in World War II, and wrote quite a history. His first sentence, and I will paraphrase it a little bit, is that the roots of the Committee on Science and Technology are in October 4th, 1957. So in a way, as the longest serving staffer by a long shot on the committee, I guess I'm the corporate memory, although maybe not the 50-year corporate memory of the committee at this point. It was a very interesting and auspicious start that the committee had in 1957. By congressional time, though, it was very fast, because it was March 58 when the committee actually started. So Congress doing anything in 5 months is sort of record time. But more important is who was on the first committee. And it's it was sort of the ultimate power committee, because it's the only committee I've ever heard of that the membership included the Speaker of the House and the minority leader for the House of Representatives. It's hard today to think just how seriously Sputnik shook the Congress, and how seriously we felt that it was necessary to respond. We had one first chairman who did not live that long, but the long-term chairman during the Apollo period is named George Miller, which is a famous name today, because his son now is the one of the old-timers in Congress and the chairman of the Committee on Education and Labor. Under George Miller's leadership, the committee's job was to keep the Apollo program on time, under budget, build the facilities, build the infrastructure. Congress is always a trailing indicator, but sometimes if we have the right fire placed under us, we can really do good work. And when I came onto the committee staff in the mid 1970s, it was still we still had the benefits of that real impressive start. And we were rated by the General Accounting Office that year as having the most professional staff in the Congress. And and I think today still we're the we probably have a third to half of the PhDs in the Congress working for us, and we're the science and technology communities, I guess one of their places of contact within the Congress. Well, if you think about from a congressional point of view, when you're hit with a big problem like we were with of knowing we're behind in when we thought we were in really good shape in science and technology, what do you do with it? The first response is to in some ways just try to buy your way out of the problem, and to a certain extent the Apollo program was that. We actually I think spent 3% of the gross national product at the peak of the Apollo program was science funding has never been like it was at that time. Fortunately, a little bit of it dribbled down to the DARPAs and the National Science Foundation, but this was an achievement because we just organized and just put all the effort we could behind to get it done. And it's no accident whenever in the scientific area someone wants to spend money, like recently on the energy bill, they talk about a new Apollo program. That is code for get out your checkbooks and let's do the problem right. So, but that, to me, that's only really part of the problem. Starting in, say, 1968 to 71 period, there are some people, perceptive people, who were starting to realize that we have a great achievement, but we haven't done it all. There's, I think, a very significant IRI study and then the Charpy report in the Nixon administration that was the beginning of administrations saying we need to focus on competitiveness. But I think the first real effort, and we were the legislative partner for a lot of this, but was when the Carter administration, which is not remembered for much, and rightfully so in some instances and wrongfully so in others, put Jordan Baruch in charge of a domestic policy review on competitiveness. And in the handout, I wrote an article about basically about the Baruch study and taking it through the end of the Clinton administration and it and showing how even though when Reagan came in, everything that the Carter administration was declared did was declared dead on arrival. Actually, the competitiveness policies of the Reagan administration, which in some ways were quite good, you know, Murray's mentioned some of the things with the trade bill of 86, but the ATP program started there. The patent reform was then we got technology transfer going for really for the first time. Lots of the things that. That the Carter administration wanted to do, we were able to do in a bipartisan way because it was a Democratic legislature. A lot of those years and Republican executive branch. But I just wanted to read the the Baruch study was 18 months, 500 people from the private sector, 250 people from the government sector from 28 agencies, and. Dozens and dozens of reports boiled down to 9 principles, and these were the principles in very shorthand: enhance transfer of technology information, increase technical knowledge through generic technology centers, clarify antitrust policy with regard to research, foster development of small innovative firms, open federal procurement to innovations. Improve the regulatory system, facilitate labor management as it relates to innovation, and maintain a supportive climate for innovation and remove legislative and administrative barriers to it. You know, I think you could substitute immigration policy for antitrust policy in that list, and you know that's pretty much what we have to work on right now. I won't go through all that's in the article, but we've learned through this process, through this essentially 15-year process. Although I don't think we really realized it was one process. Some really important things that one is that if you can really get a great broad diverse group of opinions under enlightened leadership. It's really possible to boil this down to a long-range plan of what we really need to do. The other things we learned, one thing that really sort of amazed me, but I guess I should have been smarter, is that once changes start, you know, they really start, and they go in a way you never would have dreamed that they would. I think the best example of that is the changes we did in 1984 to the antitrust laws. And what we did was a really simple change. We changed the burden of proof for attorneys' fees and the burden of proof in general in terms of of antitrust and doing research together. We said, look, it's unless you actually violate the existing antitrust laws, you haven't done anything inherently wrong by doing research together. Well, that changed the most conservative group in the country, which wasn't the Supreme Court, but the corporate attorneys overnight, and they started saying yes rather than no when people wanted to cooperate. A friend of mine who works for IBM told me in 1991, 7 years later, that they'd gone from less than five ventures doing research with others to 10,000 at that point. The change in a relatively short time changed the world. And I have to believe that that had a big impact on corporate laboratories, the Bell Labs, the IBMs, that it, and it opened the door for small business high-tech firms, which we sort of had but didn't really have in 1984. And it really changed the universities and led to startups having there. So if you really know that, I think what we learned is if you really think that that things aren't working and that there's a change that needs to be made, we'll make the change, but be ready for something more powerful than you were even thinking about. The other thing I think that we knew already but was a real lesson is that change really takes a long time to happen, and once you finally get it right, it's time to move forward again and begin the whole process over again. And I really agree with Mary's thesis that we're at I don't think probably since 1979 and 1958 have we been in a situation where we are right now in terms of the need for change. And in the second half of that article, and I won't really go through them, I'll just list a couple of them, it's we have an opportunity for dramatic change if and improvement in the economy if we do just some very simple things. Just do our digitization to the nth degree and release the data that's on paper so it can be manipulated and really turned into new wealth. I think we really underuse standards also, and including standards as a unifying process. The what changed more than anything else, I think, is the creation of the internet and the ability to do work distributively. And if you think of what standards are, they're rules that sort of that distributed group of people really should be putting together because it's the way of doing work together. I use an example in there of building standards, that how important it is to get insurers, bankers, and everybody else who uses those standards together as standards writers. And you couldn't do that 5 or 10 years ago. You really can now. And so we just need to think broadly. And the most important standard of all is quality, the Six Sigma Total Quality Management. It's time to extend that to government, and it's time to extend that to universities. Can you imagine if both government and universities learned who the real customers were, just how different the world could be? And I think that both are in more of a market than the economy than they think they are. And if the world starts moving faster, relevance is related to being able to work together. So what I would love to see is the business model, the Six Sigma, to be the common work culture. And think not of government as government or universities as universities, but how do we fit into a real modern supply chain where we have just-in-time research contributions from universities, just-in-time regulatory improvements, not regulation, from the government. So I just want to make one final point. I really like the reactive, proactive analogy, and I think what I'm trying to say is maybe we were reactive in 1957. 1978, 79, we started to be proactive. I think in terms of the America Competes Act, to a certain extent, we're reactive, but we have a whole set of proactive things that we really need to do it right. And what I would love to do is use the web to as for the next domestic policy review. If you think about, I've talked to my friend Susan about Innocentive, which is just an amazing thing in the research community, that by putting relatively small incentives out there, there's a group of 300,000 people who are willing to wrestle with problems that a corporation can't solve by themselves. Susan was telling me that the Dow has, 40% or 60%?
40%
success rate in terms of just putting an idea out there and getting it solved. I'd like to, you know, use that kind of distributive technology to get the ideas in, the great broad ideas, to and then reduce them down to the nine principles and go for it. I just wanted to mention one other source that that might be worth looking at. It isn't published yet, but it's almost there. My article is published in a new MIT journal called Innovations, and in our current issue, that's going the next one to come out for Innovations. There's an article by a Harvard Business School professor, Kareem Lakhami, and Joe Panetta, who is, I believe, the CEO of Innocentive. And that what they've tried to think through this in an academic way, like I'm not capable of doing. And they have an article called "The Principles of Distributed Innovation," which to me was taking the ideas that I was putting out there in that article and really taking them to showing how the web can do it at this point. And as a final example of what we can do, I wanted to mention a new organization, Scientists and Engineers for America, that Henry Kelly, who a lot of people here know, has been the brains behind. And what he's thinking about doing and what we're doing working with him is bringing Wikipedia and distributed technology to getting scientists and engineers more involved in politics. So I think that these new technologies, they're all different ways that that they can help move the idea of competitiveness forward. And I understand from Mary that you guys have some things up your sleeve, so I'm looking forward to working with you on some really good things as we move forward to January 20th, 2009. Thank you.
I think that since Jim has to leave before we get totally finished, if there's one or two questions specifically for him, we would take those now because he is going to have to leave shortly. Yes?
If you'd like to help out or get involved in science, scientists and engineers, how do we do that?
The website is www.sephora.org, and I think there are going to be some very interesting projects. They've developed a wiki that will be unveiled in about 2 weeks, and the idea is focusing mainly on, I think, state and federal candidates, but to be like a Wikipedia for anything that deals with science and technology related to each of the campaigns. We'd love to eventually get that down almost to the school board level, looking for ways to train scientists and engineers to become candidates for office, and also look at problems that are uniquely, that science and engineers and mathematicians are uniquely able to deal with. And one of my favorites is, although I shouldn't get even close to it, is redistricting. Can you imagine if we did mathematical optimization with a little game theory, how we would, since it's the wrong kind of optimization right now in congressional districts, we might come up with something that it would be great in a friend of the court brief in 2010.
The Republic will not survive.
We'll take one more.
Yeah.
Jim, this can be hard to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. Mary pointed out rightly that the American Competitiveness Act is authorization. And I know you're in an authorizing committee, but how do you see appropriation in turning that into reality in 08 or 09?
Well, believe it or not, that's a large part of what the appropriations fight is over right now. There's an attempt to add about $22-23 billion over the president's budget, which compared to the price of the war or inflation or any other big number, it's really a small number. a very large percentage of the difference between the Congress and the President is these programs. It's billions of that $23 billion. So the appropriations fight really is our fight right now, and so there's been a conscious effort and a bipartisan effort in the Congress to take care of these programs in this fiscal year. The as you probably know, the COMPETES Act builds up over a 7-year period. The first increment of that is pretty much in the appropriations bills, but it depends on how this fight comes out, whether we'll be able to do it or not.
Okay, thanks. Thank you very much, and we will continue with Dr. Butts.
Thank you, Mary, and I'm delighted to be here this morning, especially because this is a remarkable panel of people, I think, who have demonstrated track records of being doers. And so while we're going to talk about some challenges today, I firmly believe that there are solutions out there that we're capable of identifying and implementing. So I see this as more a way of getting our attention focused on some things that need to be addressed and then beginning to work on the solutions. My focus today is really on this kind of a subset of this bigger topic. How do universities and industries work together on solving technical challenges? And I wanted to go through quite briefly some information on the evolution of R&D in the United States. And I must start out by giving credit to Professor Chris Hill at George Mason University, who really compiled all this information. All that I did was put it on a timeline. But we have three sectors shown on this slide. At the top, what was happening in government. Next, what was happening in universities. At the bottom, what was happening in industry. And in that arrow, what's the intersection between universities and industry going on at the same time? And we can see before the Second World War, there was a sense that government funds corrupted things. So the government didn't typically fund things going on at universities nor in companies. Universities started with a focus on disseminating information. They were increasingly becoming part of this effort to create information. And companies had begun with, if you think back to the turn of the century, the sort of individual inventor, the Thomas Edison, the Henry Ford, who had good ideas and started companies. And then with time, they began to realize that they had to build an R&D infrastructure around them within their companies. In the government, we also see moving forward around the time of World War II, the need to do defense research and the growth of the weapons labs. And that also led to the growth of the defense industry. If we look at the period after World War II, of course, there was the very important idea put out by Vannevar Bush in Science, the Endless Frontier, the notion of the linear model of research, which you may not fully accept, but it was very important in driving research in a particular direction in the U.S. And so we see the growth of the government agencies that were focused on research. We see in universities an intensification of the research activity with more government funding coming in. And in companies, we see the growth of the big central research organizations. And I might point out, prior to this time, the university-industry relationship was one of supply workers. So universities generated graduates that went to work for companies. In this middle period, companies start to really believe in the linear model for research and development, and their response is, we're going to do it all ourselves. So it's really a time of corporate self-sufficiency and independence from universities. Companies wanted to do it all. They wanted to do the basic research. They wanted to do the development, the applied research, and generate the products. And they ran that experiment for a couple of decades and found out that it was too expensive and the success rate was too low, that was not a sustainable model. And then if we move into the period, so this is sort of Sputnik and a little bit beyond, we see things happening like the Arab oil embargo and other things that are going on. And we see now the growth of an era of cooperation, I'd say, between universities and industry. You may argue whether the Bayh-Dole Act was a factor that caused that. I don't really know, but certainly there was sort of around 1980 an interest in companies working more with universities in collaborative research activities. And universities also then began entering into a period where they were perceived as perhaps part of this engine for economic development, which had really not been a role for them previously. If you take out of the equation the land-grant universities, which always had a bit of a role around supporting agriculture and industry. But in general, this role of the, growth of the role of economic engine was something that was fairly new for the universities. And we see a lot of things happening. There's corporate downsizing going on. There's a decentralization of research, a lot of restructuring. As we get closer to our present time, globalization, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about. And we see more of these vertical collaborations, by which I mean going all the way up and down the value chain. So universities can be seen as being at the very beginning of that, doing the more basic research, and then you have suppliers, manufacturers, and then companies that make things that are sold to the consumer. So the value of these vertical collaborations was becoming obvious. We started hearing more about big strategic alliances, starting with things like Berkeley-Novartis and then the DuPont-MIT alliance, and most recently the one that I guess we've all heard about is the $500 million BP-Berkeley-University of Illinois alliance, which I've got to admit is pretty impressive. But I think also at that time there began to be a sense that maybe rather than cooperation, what we're sensing between companies and universities is more a sense of competition. And I wanted to just show here, now we've come into 2007 with America Competes. So America Competes is coming in at a time when there's a, perhaps some friction among the sectors that I think we really need to take a look at. So just to summarize some of the things we've already heard, America Competes, I think, is a wonderful first step. And I looked at some of the key things that it was designed to address. Definitely, it's going to increase the research investment. I think that's a clear outcome from America Competes. In terms of improving the scientist or the engineering pipeline, I'd say there's some pluses around the education programs, but it really doesn't address the immigration issue. So we've heard earlier about the importance of foreign-born science. Scientists like Dr. Hertzfeld. How are we going to make sure that the U.S. can continue to attract the best and the brightest? Say, around innovation, I still have some concerns. America Competes does direct a study to look at innovation barriers. The study will perhaps show us what some of the challenges are, but probably is not going to define the solution for us. And then finally, I put down the big X at the bottom, appropriations. As we've already heard, we have this great authorizing legislation, but no funding yet. So we all have to stay engaged with that. I wanted to come back to this issue of cooperation versus competition between companies and universities. These are some quotes from an NSF info brief from September 2006, pointing out that in 1996, the National Academies reported that there, the prevalence and vitality of research partnerships between industrial organizations and universities have increased dramatically over the last two decades, kind of reflecting that wonderful time when there was a sense of cooperation. Then a decade later, in an April 2006 meeting held at the National Academies, prominent industry and university speakers indicated that negotiations of sponsored research agreements, particularly disagreements over the treatment of intellectual property, were negatively affecting the entire industry-university research partnership in the United States. And then this final quote, a three-decade-long trend of increasingly strong ties between industry and universities may have ended. So is this true, or is this perhaps a crying wolf? My sense is that what we have is a very weak partnership that exists right now, and there are some consequences from having a weak partnership. Industry, universities, and national laboratories are all strong individually in their research capabilities. I think there's really no question about that. What they're not doing, though, is working together very well. So I would say the U.S. has still the most powerful potential innovation engine. I don't see anything like it anywhere else in the world. But it's only going to work if we can find a way to engage those three separate pieces, not so that they're working in lockstep, not so that universities are doing contract research for companies, but so that we can find a way that each of them can perform the piece of this innovation process that they do the best and link the results together in a very constructive way. So let me talk a little bit about, I mentioned that the U.S. still has the strongest potential for an innovation engine. It is different from the rest of the world. And why is that? Let me talk first about, I mentioned the Bayh-Dole Act earlier. The intellectual property climate in the U.S. is significantly different from the rest of the world, and the Bayh-Dole Act is an important reason for that, because the Bayh-Dole Act changed the way universities looked at intellectual property, allowing them to own the inventions that resulted from their federally funded research, and what's more, actually requiring them to attempt to commercialize those inventions. So it created this awareness of intellectual property and the value of intellectual property in U.S. universities that does not exist anywhere else in the world, even today, more than 20 years after Bayh-Dole. Also, and I don't want to spend much time about it, the U.S. tax laws create some problems around companies and universities working together because of the issues of private benefit. But it is a contributor to the climate now, which I think we need to address. Let me just go back to this previous slide. What that has done, really, is to create a climate in U.S. universities that's very focused on this left-hand model, which is the licensing model. So I think when universities look at innovation, they think of it as ideas start at universities, they do the research, they create inventions, and they license them, and then there's sort of another process that takes place, which is that they get commercialized. Because of the focus on the licensing model, U.S. universities have sort of looked disfavorably on the sponsored research model, which is the one that actually I would like to promote, where a company and a university work together on a research program. So they're both contributing ideas. They're both contributing to framing the problems and understanding the issues that need to be addressed, working collectively, generating inventions, and then the sponsoring company is the organization that would commercialize the inventions. I would argue that this second path is not functioning very well in the U.S. It does function well in the rest of the world, though, and that therein lies part of the challenge that we have to address. Companies have also changed in this 3 decades or so where the situation changed from cooperation to competition. I think Mary mentioned earlier that I'm in a very large global corporation. That's true, and I have seen this firsthand, and it's been a dramatic change. I can tell you in my early years at Dow, we had operations around the world, and one time I actually had to call someone in our research laboratory in Germany, and I think I spent a couple of hours deciding how I was going to say hello when I finally figured out how to dial the number. I went from that to a few years ago having speed dial on my speed dial colleagues in Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, Australia. So I've seen that transition myself, but it's been driven by many factors. First of all, and we've already heard about this, the availability of global communication tools. I can't tell you how important those are in companies. Not only is it easy to share information, it's impossible to keep information from getting spread around. So it's very easy to communicate. It's very easy to travel globally. People still do actually fly to meetings. It's not very difficult. So there's this ease of communication. We've also already heard about the interdependence of national economies. This is most definitely true. In a company like Dow, we watch the economic cycles, and we used to be advantaged because the U.S. and Europe tended to be about 180 degrees out of phase. So when one was up, the other's down. That's no longer true. Another big issue for industry is cost of energy, cost of raw materials, cost of transporting goods to market. These things all cause companies to want to put their production capabilities in the place where they have the best access to raw materials and the best margins. This is hurting the U.S. tremendously right now for the chemical industry because your fuel is our feedstock. So when the price of oil or natural gas go up, it not only hurts my company because of the cost of the energy we use in our manufacturing, but also those are our feedstocks that go to make the petrochemicals that we sell. One of the most important things, though, that's changed is the availability of a skilled workforce. We've all heard about that from manufacturing. I think that was a given many years ago. But we're seeing the growth in knowledge workers around the world. And this is being spurred by the development or the increase in quality of universities around the world. The Chinese government is absolutely determined to have the finest universities in the world. And they have studied the U.S., they've come to look at how we do it, and they've told us they're trying to beat us. If you want, look at that list that says the 500 best universities in the world. That's generated by Shanghai Jiao Tong University, and they want to see where did they start and how long is it going to take them to get to the top of the list. So there's a definite increase in the quality of the knowledge workers outside the U.S. Labor costs are more favorable in some parts of the world, but as I think Mary alluded to, that differential is going to go away pretty quickly. So it's not really cost of labor. There's the growth in market size. So if you ask me, why does the Dow Chemical Company want to build plants in China? It's not because of cheap labor. It's because there's an enormous market there to buy our products. That's the big driver. There are billions of people in Asia who don't have Dow products in their homes right now, and we'd like them to have those. So that's the real driver for putting both our manufacturing and our research abroad. We're seeing better infrastructure support around the rest of the world. In some cases, there's government incentives that are provided to encourage companies to put their R&D facilities outside the U.S. And then I made a final comment here. There's more favorable intellectual property treatment and university collaborations abroad. So all of these are factors that are causing companies to look much more broadly, not to offshore their capabilities, but to globalize and have them all linked together so that they're very highly connected. I will tell you, Dow globalized research and development in 1996, and it happened overnight. It was a very interesting experience for me because we had operations around the world, but they were all managed locally. In 1996, we turned the key and said, from here on, we manage globally by either business unit or research capability. I was a manager in the analytical sciences laboratory, so I went from one day having a group of about 75 people in Midland, Michigan, doing various technologies, to the next day having a group of 60 people now in 9 locations around the world, all doing atomic spectroscopy and inorganic analysis. I went from totally locally focused to totally globally focused in one day, essentially. And it totally changed the way we managed our resources, the way we managed our people, and the way we managed our projects. So this globalization is a reality in corporations. It's important to keep in mind, although corporations have globalized, they are still spending a lot of money on research and development in the United States. And you can see from this chart that right now, the amount of money spent by industry on research is about twice as big as the amount spent by the federal government. So if we look back to that earlier model where universities really were totally dependent on the government for research funding, you can see if you want to find out how can universities fill the gap if government funding becomes tougher to get, there's a very attractive source of money, which is companies, but we have to find a way to stimulate that cooperation and get away from the competitiveness. I mentioned earlier that U.S. universities have become very focused on the licensing model. I just want to point out through some data from the Association of University Technology Managers that while I think it's quite appropriate for universities to try to maximize their licensing revenue, you can see by the comparison of these bars, the yellow ones show for all the universities that report their licensing income to Autumn, that they only get about one-third as much money from licensing income as they do right now from industry-sponsored research. So to try to maximize licensing revenue at the expense of industry sponsorship of research really doesn't make sense from a financial standpoint. So I think you'd want to try to increase both of them, but definitely funding for research is something that you could look at more as the bird in the hand. And so I think we need to look at what are the policy implications. So university policies in the U.S. are skewed towards strong intellectual property control on the part of the university so that universities can maximize their licensing revenue. I would argue that a more flexible intellectual property position would allow universities to attract funding from industry, which might otherwise go overseas. Just wanted to point out one thing that I think we all know, and these numbers are obviously approximations. This chart actually was put together by a colleague of mine at the University of Utah, Terry Ring, who's on the engineering faculty there. But he was trying to look at, so what's the risk? You know, how tough is it to go from an idea to commercial success? And he broke it down into steps, kind of from the faculty point of view, that your chances of getting a grant from writing a proposal are about 1 in 10. From having work that was completed to having a publication, chances are about 1 in 2. From a publication to a patent, it's 1 in 100. From a patent to a profit, it's 1 in 250. And so the overall probability of going from a good idea to profit is 1 in 500,000. Okay. So that's the point I want to bring home, that this is a risky and costly proposition. Companies do have the ability to make these investments, because they are able to weather the storm if something fails. So in my company, I'd say about 1 in 10 of the things that we try to commercialize works. Okay. But we're big enough, and we manage our intellectual property in such a way that the one success can pay for the 9 failures. And so I think this really points out a risk model that we need to keep in mind. And this is my final slide. The choice really is ours. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. innovation engine is extremely powerful, but it's not engaged. How can we find a way to bring together these tremendous research capabilities of the national laboratories, U.S. companies, and the universities? And I would argue that we have to reconstruct our funding and our risk models so that they support collaboration across the sectors rather than encouraging these three pieces of the innovation engine to compete with one another. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That's going to generate some questions for sure. Bill von Villian will be our next speaker, and just to indicate how small the world is sometimes, Jim had given me a note which says that Bill was Senator Lieberman's first intern when Lieberman was a state senator, when both Bill and Jim were together in school. So, you know, the world comes around again.
What Jim didn't say was that we were in Yale Divinity School together, which gave us our scientific training. You know, actually, in some ways, I'll build on what the previous speakers have done and pick up, particularly on a point that Susan set forth, which is a whole globalization point. And I want to talk about, after a little bit of background, how different the innovation world is now than it was at Sputnik time 50 years ago. And that the great alliance that came out of Sputnik, what's happened to that? What's that look like? And, you know, we could never have anticipated it, but then, of course, we never could have anticipated what Sputnik actually was. We thought we knew what Sputnik was, which was a staging point to get, you know, people into space. But, of course, that wasn't what Sputnik turned into at all. In fact, that little blinking Sputnik light, you know, probably in retrospect, is far more important than the stage we thought we were moving towards, which is, you know, people in space. I mean, think of the plethora of satellite activity and the staggering economic evolutions that just that plain blinking light satellite has led to. And that's one point. And then, you know, then Charlie's real role comes in. You know, we got DARPA out of Sputnik. Sputnik, you know, forced Eisenhower and allowed Eisenhower to pull the space programs back from the services and consolidate them in DARPA, and then he changed his mind a few months later and turned them over to NASA, which left, you know, DARPA hands-free, so DARPA had to do something. And they did IT, right? And Charlie was a fabulous leader at that unbelievable stage. So, you know, we got the, you know, direct linear kind of way, we got the whole IT revolution out of Sputnik. So I'm looking at the kind of organizational structure that got put together at that time, and then looking and trying to update it and think about where it stands and what the meaning of that is, particularly cueing off Susan's point on globalization. You know, we all think about comparative advantage for the United States. That was the conceptual driver behind the America Competes Act that Congress recently passed. You know, we all know that the old model of comparative advantage was based on natural resource advantage, and that was permanent. That was, you know, near eternal. And then out of World War II and reinforced in Sputnik, greatly reinforced in Sputnik, came a comparative advantage and innovation model that the U.S. spawned. In World War II, we laid the foundations. We laid the investment levels of massive federal R&D support. And then at the end of World War II, Vannevar Bush salvaged one piece of that extremely connected model that we had built in the course of World War II, where R&D and prototyping and production were all very closely linked. At a time of dismantling of federal investment in 1945, Vannevar Bush decides, let's hang on to one piece of that, which is the fundamental research investment side. So Sputnik then comes back and drives a new influx of R&D funding and science talent support. And comparative advantage, beginning in World War II, building on the endless frontier, but really multiplying as a result of those Sputnik investments, was a critical kind of gift that movement created. So we celebrate Sputnik, but in some ways we ought to be celebrating the reemergence that Sputnik created of that connected science model of World War II. And let me just say what I mean here. By funding only fundamental research, we disaggregated the collected, connected model. We made the government role at one stage, the earliest stage, and in fact the cheapest stage, which is part of why I think Finney Rabot picked it. But we therefore institutionalized the valley of death. We made it very hard to get from that R stage to the D stage. The same kind of problems that, you know, Susan was talking about earlier are still deeply embedded, institutionalized in our system. But interestingly, part of what Sputnik led to was the revival of that World War II connected model, where a translational agency like DARPA was able to sort of start putting those pieces and connecting them back together again at the different stages of innovation, not simply the stages of discovery or invention. You know, we had at that era, coming out of Sputnik, a truly national innovation system. And there were two powerful governmental investments that got reinforced in that era, which also happened to be the key investments behind economic growth, the two really direct factors. I mean, there's many parts of an ecosystem of economic growth, but the two you have to get right are technological and related innovation, which Robert Solow figured out. In other words, you got to have R&D investment, and you've got to have human capital engaged in research, Paul Romer's comment, his thought. In other words, you've got to have a talent pool. You've got to have an R&D system, and you've got to have the talent in that pool. There's no getting around having to have those factors. And those are the two biggest reinforcements that we got out of the Sputnik investments. We had been building that system all along since World War II, but a huge reinforcement at that stage. And that enabled a national innovation system in this country. Richard Nelson, who's one of the key authors of the concept of national innovation system, argues that innovation, as I was saying, operates within a system, and it's a very complex system of institutions, firms, and organizations, and public and private players, and practices and policies that enable institution. But Nelson argued that it is best analyzed at the national level. Is it still national? Is innovation still national? Well, there's a significant argument that the nation may not be the best measurement unit anymore for innovation systems. But let's remember, too, in other words, what I'm saying is let's look at the direction we're moving, and it's a global direction, but let's remember, too, what's not moving, right? What's still staying stable? And I'm going to try and draw out some of that comparison in this discussion. You know, the two direct innovation factors are still very, almost completely dependent upon the nation state. Right? Fundamental research, it's funded by the government. It's not funded by industry. So in Susan's chart, and I know she's fully onto this concept, industry does development. The R number, the research number, is really remains a governmental creation, predominantly, I mean, not exclusively. And then talent, right, another key innovation factor, a critical fundamental direct innovation factor. Science and technology talent still is overwhelmingly reliant upon national support from government. So, you know, innovation may be moving in a different kind of non-national direction, but when you look at the two direct innovation factors, and there's a lot of factors, but the two most direct ones are still very nation-state owned. All right, so let's look at the allies that came out of that Sputnik situation. Out of Sputnik, and indeed emerging in World War II before it, we had a sort of a tripart alliance of DOD and defense, universities, and industry in an innovation system. They were close, interactive innovation allies, particularly during the connected model of World War II, but that then reemerges again, particularly through DARPA, in the course of the Sputnik period. Well, we're working on a completely new model. Industry, as Susan provided good data for us on, is really going global. Now, universities are trying to figure this out. They're kind of uncertain. A lot of their talent pool is drawn from abroad, although the great majority of that, fortunately for us, stays here still. So universities are funded out of a nation state model for their research and their talent support. But they sure got an eye on an international economy as well, because their historic good times and bad times for this industry partners have gone in that direction. And their students are going to be going in that direction to the extent they work with industry. So universities are sort of hanging here trying to figure out what's going on. And then our national security leadership, if anything, is ever more dependent upon U.S. technological leadership. I don't think DOD is spending a lot of time worrying about this kind of new globalization on the innovation side, but it's the player with the most complicated problem by far on this triumvirate that's now splitting apart from the historical model we built, from the national innovation model we built at the time of Sputnik. So, you know, we have a globalized world economy. There's no getting around it. There's a growing number of prosperous nations. Therefore, there are going to be a growing number of innovation system competitors. You know, China in particular, but India as well, and certainly Korea, and numerous other countries have understood the mass higher education model that the United States created out of the great land-grant university acts and so on, and the Sputnik funding for national defense fellowships in science and technology. So there's a lot of people that understand that model, and the mass education, higher education model is now being picked up in numerous countries. And the incredible competitive opportunities that created for the United States are now well understood. In addition, we understand, too, that basic science can get performed in many places and more cheaply, and IT enables it, some of the things Jim was talking about, enables this dispersal of R&D. And R&D, in many ways, has to be, as Susan was pointing out, has to be tied by industry to emerging global markets. Industry is outsourcing R&D. You know, and this is in parallel with a dispersed manufacturing, distributed manufacturing system that lots of U.S. firms are moving towards. IT with IT-based standards and IT-based designs means that instead of having to have a rich, deep supply chain that you're in continuous communication with because of the tacit knowledge that has to get handed off at every stage, IT enables a big reduction in those kinds of strings of connections because it's been so standardized. So we now have much more of a Lego model for manufacturing, and you can build those Legos to very exacting designs and standards in many places now. And the iPod is probably the classic example of this. So that suggests, is there going to be distributed R&D? I'll skip this. And this is, I just want to put it in a geopolitical backdrop for the U.S. for a second. You know, we've gone through sort of historically about three phases now of U.S. attitudes towards the dispersal of economic power. And, you know, Hamilton created the first model, and that one lasted well through World War II and well through Sputnik. Hamilton understood that U.S. political liberty, our freedom, would be extremely dependent upon building a very strong, independent commercial manufacturing base. And every bit as important as getting the Constitution right was getting that model of economic independence right. And in many ways, that's Hamilton's, you know, great contribution to freedom in this country. And that model enables the United States to be strong and emerge eventually as a global superpower. And then in the Cold War, we found that we could allow economic integration with our allies, and that would serve our geopolitical exercise of soft power. And we did it, and we began to integrate our economy with Europe's and Korea's and Japan's and so forth, other allies. Now we're in a third stage built on that Cold War model where it's just happening. Right, widespread dispersal is really just happening. And we haven't really thought through the geopolitical implications of this. It's just beginning to dawn on us. And the reality, too, to get back to the issue of comparative advantage, and you know, we'll find, you know, what does Samuelson say, right? He's wrote a very thoughtful piece on this subject a couple of years back, pointing out in this great endless debate of the economics profession over free trade, Samuelson pointed out that comparative advantage in innovation is not permanent like a comparative advantage in resources. It can shift as competitors acquire innovation advantage. And he pointed out that this is a relentless historical trend in U.S. history, in European history, in the histories of large-scale economy. This has happened many times. You know, cite one, leadership of the Industrial Revolution passes to the United States when the United States figures out interchangeable machine-made parts first. So Samuelson concludes that a productivity gain in one country, especially when it's coupled with a big wage differential, can benefit that country alone while permanently hurting the other country by reducing the gains from trade possible between the two countries, quote unquote. And all this is what he calls long-run Schumpeterian, you know, creative destruction of capitalism effects. And he paints the picture of evolving comparative advantage in the world as a roulette wheel. So we got to keep in mind that the consequences of globalization do have comparative advantage and economic consequences for what we're doing. But let's look a little bit deeper, right? Susan talked about the evolution of a distributed R&D model at the industry level, but let's keep in mind, too, sort of what can't go, right? Sort of what aspects that doesn't apply to. So innovation itself, as opposed to a discovery phase, as opposed to an invention phase, you know, innovation is a larger something that creates productivity gains that spread to the economy. That first set of applications in an innovation phase, they mostly have to stay in a room together, right? That's probably not going to change. It's very face-to-face. It's very, to use a real estate term, location, location, location. Innovation requires great groups, probably unlike still the discovery and invention stages. So you can move some things, right? You can move research that pursues incremental advance, right? Which is primarily what U.S. large companies pursue, right? They're not, generally speaking, pursuing radical advance. They're pursuing incremental advance. So that may shift worldwide. It's much harder, assuming the U.S. maintains a comparative advantage in some territories of innovation, it's much harder to shift that innovation stage. That doesn't mean, however, that I'm in any way denigrating incremental innovation. It's a very key step. I mean, if we only had radical innovation, we'd still be flying across the Atlantic in the Wright brothers' kite, right? Somebody had to figure out the 747, right? That's all incremental innovation. So it's very, very important. These two have to work in tandem together, so they're very connected. So thinking, I think we need to start figuring out, given the movement in collaborative, not so much R, but collaborative D, how do you still obtain national gain or national opportunity even from collaborative R&D, right? I don't think anybody's really thought that through, but we're moving towards that model. You know, Congress is becoming increasingly nervous about these developments. You know, the House Science Committee has begun hearings on the globalization of universities. I don't think that's a huge issue since the Feds still fund them and pretty much own them, but maybe over time. There's a very strong anti-university movement on both left and right in Congress. The three main sources of funding for universities, federal R&D, has been quite stagnant. Tuition is now, the whole issue of tuition price controls are now being presented on the House side. The Senate Finance Committee is after the third leg of university income, which is endowments. Are those going to be taxed? Are payouts on endowments going to be mandatory? So the whole financial model behind the very powerful institution that we created out of World War II and then reinforced out of Sputnik, it's under a real challenge, really, for the first time in that whole time period. And particularly with the globalization of industry R&D, the university player becomes a fairly significant factor in retaining collaborative and comparative advantage opportunities in the United States. So that model is now under siege a bit. Now, obviously, it's not only R&D that are behind U.S. comparative advantages. The culture of risk-taking, a tolerance of failure, the kind of models of venture capital and angel capital that promote radical innovation and entrepreneurial advantage are key here, the kind of flexible and open workforce we have. Those are all very big things, although, as Charlie in a recent interview pointed out, a big Sputnik-era U.S. advantage of connected science, which got revived through DARPA, is actually on the decline at this point in that same institution. I think we're going to have to work on understanding the implications of the breakup of this three-part alliance. I think it has huge consequences for our ability to continue to fund R&D out of the federal government. You know, if Congress decides that investments in R&D are being spread through a global model, not in their districts, you know, the gig is up, right? But where should that tripartite alliance be? Obviously, U.S. companies need to be international. Markets are there. So that's not evil by any means. But where is, if we have built an economy on an innovation advantage, an innovation comparative advantage, how is that advantage going to remain for national well-being? And what's the role of the different players? In some ways, I think DOD's role may be the most important here, because as I was saying early, they have a huge stake in innovation and technology leadership, and historically have played a powerful role as an innovator engine for the other players. And it may be time for DOD to think about what the level of its re-engagement might be. Universities will have to think about this. Industry will have to think about it, too, because if fundamental research remains a key to radical innovation, that's something that industry is going to continue to want to have access to. So the relationships that Susan was talking about become very important in that context. We're going to have to think about a foreign policy for the innovation system. I don't think we can postpone this a whole lot longer, right? Because there are political consequences to postponing it, support consequences for postponing it, for misunderstanding what's going on. And there's lots of reason to understand, as I was trying to say in part, why comparative advantage will remain based upon national models, but there are also other aspects that are going to be changing. And I think we need to understand these and begin to think through some policy understandings that will help provide our political leadership in particular, but the country in general, some guidance and some thought about how we're going to have a more flexible system, and it's going to be a more open system, and it's going to be a more international system. But how is it going to work? And how is it going to work for continuing U.S. opportunity? Thank you.
Bill, thank you very much. I think you have heard a rather broad review here today of some of the issues, and I think these were very responsive to the celebration of Sputnik, because as you see from this group, most of us believe that we're sort of in a situation where the United States is going to have to decide what direction it's going to take in the next little while, because we really have some real economic issues that are going to have to be addressed. And part of those will have to be addressed through an innovation policy that actually works and begins to have some impact on these. So let's open it up for questions and for any of the panelists, if we can.
Okay. Could I make a comment?
Sure, absolutely.
I'd like to start with a comment that underscores the magnitude of the problem. I think no one has said it quite as starkly as I feel I need to. What is at stake is nothing less than the survival of the American position as the most affluent country in the world. It's that simple. There are many competitors that compete in various ways, and they have some things that we don't have. And this is a long discussion that I don't plan to open that. I just want to say it's that serious. Is not just the next year budget. I mean, to be blunt, it's much more. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's an important issue because what we're talking about is strategy here, and strategy is never a one-year issue, okay? Yes, sir.
Is that working? Yeah. Thank you. Bill, I actually had a question for you. You characterized the U.S. as a risk-taking culture, and I'd say that's the conventional wisdom. But when I actually look at our U.S. society, I see a group of people that really tends to be very timid and conformist. So I'm wondering in what way, what is the basis of your characterization as U.S., of the U.S. as a risk-taking nation?
It may still be timid, but, you know, compared to what, right, maybe the way to put it. And it's, you know, the IT revolution spawned these new institutional arrangements for the capital that it had to have to get stood up, right, because that was not going to come out of traditional lending capital or traditional market-based equity capital. So to get that innovation wave that, you know, we're probably at least 15 years into, but has dominated the sort of growth of the U.S. economy and contributed across the board to many, many sectors. To get that innovation wave, we had to come up with a whole slew of new players, as I suggested at one point. We had to come up with venture capital and IPOs and angel capital. In other words, a whole set of new institutional mechanisms to support this kind of wave. Well, those all came about because of a relative tolerance in our society for risk-taking. And, you know, this is not a new tendency in the society. I mean, you know, the United States early on started collecting people who had failed all over the world and came here and got another shot, right? It's very deep in our culture. And it's, you know, from the early bankruptcy laws and no-debtor prison on, this society's been pretty tolerant of giving you a round of opportunities, and in many ways our whole education structure is very, very flexible and allows you to sort of start over again at any number of stages. So it's a deep cultural thing here. Other societies don't have that kind of attitude, and failure is punished, right? We tend to be a bit more tolerant of it here. So I think that turns out, you know, if you look at the statistics, you know, Susan was laying out of, you know, the 1 in 500,000 shot, right, in order to get something actually into production from the idea stage. If that's the ratio, it's really smart to have a lot of risk-taking that's tolerated in this society. And I think we're actually pretty good at this. By no means perfect, though, I agree.
Yes, sir. Susan, the Duke versus Mady and then the Wharf stem cell action had made several universities concerned that intellectual property owned by one university would stand in the way of research performed at other universities. And the universities have taken action to try to ensure that that is not the case. That is, that university-owned IP does not stand in the way of research at other universities. Do you see industry-university collaborations being consistent with that principle in general?
First of all, I think it's a very fine principle that there are certain, especially research tools, Artie, that really, I think, need to be in the public domain so that you can foster further research and speed the progress. I think on the industry-university collaboration side, there's room for that, but I think perhaps what hasn't been fully taken into account in developing some of these relationships is that companies often have made a big investment already in framing the problem that they want to work on a university with. So they've already invested significantly. So in some cases, it's going to be hard for a company to justify, let's just make all the research results available. I think publication is great, and I think most of the companies that I work with are fully support publishing results from their university-sponsored research, but in terms of letting other companies use them for free, I'd say that's probably not a model that's going to get strong support.
Yes, sir.
I think Dr. Hertz
Feld, you put it very well in saying that in the end we're talking about standard of living, way of life, and there's an assumption in this panel that innovation contributes to it. But I'd like to ask a broader question about the standard of living and way of life. If you look at the United States and our historical advantages that led us to be the most affluent country, they included things like abundant resources, very cheap land, rapidly expanding population, homogeneous markets. These weren't exactly innovation things. But my question now is, given that we're becoming less of a country with the advantages I just mentioned, can we learn from other countries? I can give some examples of ones that have maintained affluence and probably innovation, even though they lack resources. Switzerland, several of the Nordic countries, arguably Japan, but that's a difficult one, and maybe even in some respects Singapore. So my question to the panel is, are there things that we can learn from other countries who have successfully adapted to the changing environment?
Well, I think Switzerland is a special case. They took up banking in a big way. And if you do, you're never short of money. I'm dead serious, by the way. It's a joke as well, but it's dead serious. I think there was an enormous investment in America by foreign banks and rich people and countries in the early 1900s and even after World War I. Nowadays, people complain that foreigners buy our companies. That used to be called investing in our companies. Mm-hmm. So I think the perspective isn't quite right. I think we have a lot of learning to do about our own history, and we tend to be terrible at history. It's dull, you know, dates and so on. We heard today a wonderful impression of the big ideas that drive history. I was really thrilled by the papers that were given because, like few things that I've heard lately, it was really serious about big stuff. And it is big stuff, and you really have to understand it. I think we have to learn that our innovation needs to stretch into other things, not just physics and chemistry and electrical engineering and signal processing. One thing I like to mention in this context, though most people don't like the example, but I think it's important, is public relations. We are the superpower in public relations. We really are. If you meet the best firms, you go to New York or Washington. There's some very good ones in London. I don't mean to belittle everybody else. But boy, we really got it. And we spend it on finding out what customers want or what they say they want, how they react to products, how to persuade. We are great at persuading people to change their mind. And it's become increasingly important in politics. And that's a very important but separate issue. It's a huge paradox that how is it that this happened to us, that we're we lost so much foreign, particularly, appreciation of America. Well, that's an oversight. I think one of our basic strengths is to persuade people. It's in no way tied into our national soft power exercise, which I'm all for. The Congress had made it harder by keeping the government from playing any role in it. Well, that's a good thing. The output is not a great blessing. I want to stop here. This could go on for hours.
Okay, Jim? I think all you have to do to answer the question is go to one of those countries. And I remember we went to Taiwan a couple years ago and met with some of their business leaders. First question out of the box was about ADRs, and I was thinking, my God, if they are watching and a change in policy that was happening with regard, and I was thinking, if they're watching that closely, what we're doing, we're just being absolute fools not watching what others are doing as well. And the countries are very open if we take the time to go over. And a corollary point is that one real difference that hurts us is that we don't have that many scientists, engineers, businessmen in government, in our legislature. there just isn't a natural sensitivity. And some of the, and I think that one of the most important things in Bill's talk was his litany of things where universities feel under attack. I think the underlying principles that lead to our competitiveness, like Bayh-Dole, like bankruptcy law, are not givens unless we are being vigilant in making sure that Congress understands exactly why these are important. I think the changes, the most recent changes in the bankruptcy law were a step backwards for innovation. And believe me, there are people who would love to unravel Bayh-Dole for all the wrong reasons. Not only do we have to watch what's happening overseas, but communicate that to and get the our decision makers overseas so they can see.
In some ways, your question was, how are we going to do it for the next round, right? In other words, how are we going to maintain and playing off Charlie's very important question. If growth economics is right, and I think there's a significant consensus that it is, that we only have one move, right? We can only innovate, right? In other words, if economic growth, 60, whatever it is, 70% plus of economic growth worldwide, certainly in this country, is dependent upon innovation, then we have no other move. We're not going to get it out of resource advantage, right? We're not going to get it out of, a range of other factors. We've got to get this right. So there's a moment here, I think, that's coming quickly, and we need to do this, which is really think hard about our innovation system in a global context. How is it going to work, and how is it going to work brilliantly? For continued advantage. Now, it's not a bad thing that China is bringing 400 million new people into its middle class, right? That's a wonderful thing for the world. It's not a bad thing that, China is now way past us in the number of higher education degrees that it offers. It's now 21 million degrees in higher education annually. It's an astonishing number. That's great, right? But if we can't figure out how to get rich off another 400 million people coming into the middle class, then shame on us, right? We got to tune this thing up and get it updated and rethought. And the American Competes Act, in many ways, was building off consensus conclusions about our innovation system that there wasn't a lot of disagreement about. These are, more R&D funding, some new institutional fixes, more investment in science and math and engineering education. Those are consensus policies that we've been onto for at least 20-plus years. But we're going to have to take another look here fairly soon at what the next generation of policies is going to look like.
Let me just make one comment about that. We do have some advantages. We certainly don't have the population background that either India or China has to develop over time. But if you look at us versus the rest of the industrialized world, particularly Europe and Japan, Japan is essentially out of people, and so is Western Europe. We are not. But we have to. That means, though, that group of young people coming into our system, if we don't educate them and get them to the point where they can do the innovation that we've done in the past, we won't have any possibility at all. And this is a really interesting question, because some of those kids coming into the system don't look like us that's sitting in this room today. As I look around this particular audience, they don't look like us. Their background is not the same. And we have to be able to figure out how you're going to motivate them to be part of this innovation engine, because they are where it will be in another 10 years from now. Let me ask, there's a lady back there who's had her hand up for a long time, if I can find her. She just went. She gave up. Okay. Okay, please.
Dr. Good. Yeah, Dr. Good. I'm Gary Bottorf, and I represent Thomas Jefferson High School for Science and Technology just across the river here. Just a personal note, Sputnik changed my life. I went to college as a result of seeing that satellite, got in the intelligence business, got in the business of reading of photography, and ended up starting a Cold War museum here in town and so forth. So that's how personal it affected me. The question I have is this issue of asking the panel to think broader and what feeds the universities, and that's the elementary and the high schools. And Thomas Jefferson is truly unique. It's recognized around the world as the top high school in the country for science and technology. But here's the problem. If you look at all the charitable giving, about $260 billion in the United States, I think, about 60% go to education. Almost all of that, including the Bill Gates Foundation of Schools of the Future, go to the underperforming students. We have 1,800 students across the river that basically get nothing more than what the public school system gives everybody else, and we have 12 embedded labs in the school that cost $1 million more a year than any other school, and we're sending more kids to MIT than any other school in the country. But I'm out there selling cookies trying to get support for the labs so that we can turn these kids out. How do we expand the thinking so that what goes down even to the high school, even the elementary schools?
Bill, you want to try that with what's in the COMPETES Act that might actually attack that problem? Because I think it's an extraordinarily good question.
Well, there are major pieces on K through 12 education. Right. If anything, the focus of the education pieces in the COMPETES Act is on the K through 12 system. Now, that doesn't mean, however, that those investments are going into, you know, the kind of science and technology high schools that have been a unique contributor. And I mean, there's always an emphasis on aggregate data when we look at S&T statistics. But the reality is that there are very key and critical institutions that play very disproportionate roles. So while the aggregate data is important, you have to understand the institutional history too. And, you know, if you think about the history of Nobel Prizes awarded in the United States, if we didn't have, say, Bronx High School of Science, right, in that 50s, 60s, 70s period, you know, it would be a very different picture of rewards. So one of the things that we need to understand as we think about innovation systems is the role of critical institutions, right? How do we, I talked earlier about how there's two direct innovation factors that growth economics has given us, shorthand R&D, shorthand talent, right? But I would argue that there is a third absolutely critical factor, which is how that R&D and that talent come together in an organizational institutional sense. We have to get that brilliantly right to truly get innovation, given the odds Susan was telling us, out of that system. So a new kind of focus on critical institutions, I think, is a very important part of the kind of next debate on innovation that we're going to have. And the role of institutions like yours, you know, is a very important part of that discussion.
Here to come over, just give me a call, I'll give you my card, and see what's going on is truly unbelievable.
Let me get the lady in the back who has had her hand up for a long time. Yes, you.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank this panel. I just think it's been such a thought-provoking group of talks, and as much as I come to things like this, this is the first really deep thinking I've heard, and so I'm really grateful to all of you. So I kind of want to throw out something. There's an old saw that necessity is the mother of invention. And I guess the thing that kind of got to me is that we are at risk of not being the richest country in the world. And I guess I would say that having that as our goal is what's destroying us. And, you know, when I think of who got us right, it's kind of Jonathan Turner and Vannevar Bush who talk about, you know, the closing of the frontier and then the reopening of the frontier with our minds. And it seems to me that when you're fat and happy, you're just not that interested in innovating. And it's not clear to me how having wealth be such an end in itself is really going to help this. And I think that that's a way in which we've kind of lost our way. I don't think that's where we were 50 and 100 years ago. I don't mean to sound so reactionary or conservative, but anyhow.
Anybody want to tackle that one? Yes, take a shot.
Let me take a shot. First of all, it's a wonderful question, and I kind of like the attitude behind it. Let me tell you, everybody thinks that World War II was easy. We won it, after all. Big time. Let me tell you, it was a desperate time. People have forgotten. I'm old enough. I escaped from Europe in the middle of it. It was a desperate time, and not until 1942, when all the threats were stopped in place, not yet rolled back, did it look like we might actually win. And we came out of that with a new threat of comparable dimensions, which turned into the Cold War very quickly, which was also a desperate time. People don't understand that anymore. Let me tell you, I mean, I can give long talks. I'm, in fact, writing my own personal stories about all of this. And boy, did that sharpen everybody's mind. I mean, when Eisenhower got hold of the Sputnik and related problems, you have to, I'm just reading about this a little bit. There were crises in Berlin every year or two that looked like either a big loss in the struggle against, you know, holding the frontier, or just a great disaster. In fact, I joined ARPA because the Berlin Wall went up, and this is another story, not for this time, but I was happened to be in Paris at the time, and it was pretty dicey. 9/11 is a curious case because it has frightened people. I mean, the children are afraid. Many, too many. But we haven't had the follow through. And that's an interesting story, which is another few hours. But I think looking ahead, you're absolutely right. And the trends that we've kind of hinted at, that many of us are much more concerned about than may have actually come through, that will focus the country, you bet.
Mary, I'd like to comment on this one. I think you're absolutely right that necessity or, you know, dire peril can really inspire great thinking. But I would also say it's part of the American culture to want better things for our children. And part of what I see happening now is this attempt among thinking people to try to raise the issues before we have a problem. So rather than waiting until, and I see Debbie Stein sitting there, and I know her important role in Rising Above the Gathering Storm, it was to try to get people to think about this and imagine what the consequences will be like if we don't take any action. So I would say we're in a different mode of responding now. It's one of trying to project what the potential outcome or likely outcome would be and drive that desire to make the change before there's a negative consequence. And I'll say, I'm doing it because of my two sons who are now in college, and I'd like them. I'm pretty sure I can ride, you know, the momentum of our current system until the end of my days, but I don't think my sons can.
Yeah, I would like to echo that. I think that's absolutely correct. But if you look at some of these things that are actually true right now, they're also things we've not really put in perspective yet. There's some new numbers that came out of the Commerce, I believe they came out of the Commerce Department. Connie's here somewhere and may know for sure. But it's my reading of that data that right now, as of now, 50% of all of the people who are working people in the United States are all in the they're all on wages, hourly wages, and their wages are between $8 and $15 an hour. Now, you can calculate what that means in standard of living as well as I can. And when you have 50% of the people that are in that position, I suggest we're getting to the point where this is a really difficult thing to sustain a democracy that we are used to. So there are some real issues out there that part of this thing has to attack with respect to the people, as well as some of the other issues that are there. And we've got one person in the audience. Mark Stanley is here, and he is the director of the Advanced Technology Program. Many of you know that program, and if you don't, I once described it to a group of people as the only thing that resembled the perils of Pauline. Those of you who are old enough to remember the old serial things about Pauline, the perils of Pauline. If you remember, at the end of each segment, she was either tied to the railroad track and the train was coming. Well, ATP has been like that, and every time has managed to get some kind of relief and come back in some form.
But what I wanted, the reason I want to make the point is that program has been more looked at by other countries and is in the process right now of being duplicated with very large numbers across those people who turn out to be our competitors. And we're still quarreling about it at some very low level of funding at the present time. And it's part of that issue that Bill Bonvillian in particular brought up and Susan brought up about the fact that we've got to get back to a model of innovation, which is an integrated model, not just a research piece here and a prototype here and then a development and commercialization piece behind. So some of those sorts of things are going to have to be thought through as well. Mark, you want to make a comment? I'm not sure I should let him, but anyway.
A comment and then a question to the panel.
You all should be applauded because this has been a fabulous, fabulous morning. In the new program created under the COMPETES Act, which I hope will get funded, is the new program called Technology Innovation Program. And it actually speaks to Susan's point. For the first time, universities will be permitted to lead joint ventures as long as they're associated with companies. And I'm very excited about the way in which we're going to shape this program to critical national need, moving it much more into a sort of, if the government wouldn't get involved, what would happen? And the changes in the new program are going to be significant against the former program, which I, of course, led. My question that I wanted to ask the panelists is, and in all the discussion this morning, I have not heard the role states play or have not yet learned how to play. And I'd be interested in your comments about that being one of the legs of economic development and innovation.
Yeah, let me start with that. I am right in the middle of that at the moment. We are just about, hopefully, to start with the STEP program at the Academy, a subcommittee on what is happening in economic development with the states. And what is happening out there with the states is many of them have decided that they're not going to get the support from the federal government they wanted, and so they will simply try to step out and do it themselves. And if you look at states, from the small ones to the big ones, they are beginning to put innovation policies in place themselves. And Susan, this is a plus for the problem that you talked about with universities interacting with industry. Because what is happening to the state universities around the country is nobody is asking you whether you want to do that or not. You are very rapidly getting into the position where if you wish the state to continue to be friendly to you, you will indeed help the commercialization and the economic development of the state. And that's in turning out students that hopefully will stay within your economic sphere if possible, and you will indeed be in a position to interact with the industry that's going to make that go. And my view is that over the next 5 years, the innovation policies that are coming out of the states is going to be a major piece of what we can count on. Because these states, some of them are really serious, because you take Michigan and Illinois and some of the Rust Belt states, they have a crisis on their hands. The nation as a whole may not, but they do, and they understand that, and they're beginning to do things to do something about it. So I think that that's an excellent question, and I suspect all of the rest of you know of the similar projects that's going on.
We've reached the end of our time, but I'll ask. I see there's a couple more questions. Do you want to try and take them, or what's your?
Let's do about one. Let's take two more questions, and then we'll short ones, please. This gentleman's had his hand up for a very long time, right here. You on the front, yeah. he's been very patient.
Thank you. Echoing some of the other questions, I'm a little concerned about what still appears to be a somewhat xenophobic view, and not looking internationally for suggestions, if not solutions, but things that we could build on. This is particularly true in education and particularly true in what I see in the America Competes Act. It's a lot of the same old stuff, just doing more of it, because there are a lot of very innovative programs around the world in education. I would also suggest that we have the same thing when we talk about our H-1B visa program, and we have the same thing when we kind of dismiss things like TECUS and the studies that have been done by China on innovation and Korea in innovation, and just say, well, we don't need any of that. Let's not look at it. That they're a different situation. I suggest that we need to look at how policy is being studied by these other countries and try to do the same thing, not necessarily the same thing, but build on those. And in that same light, there's a study on the rise and fall of nations that I didn't hear about here that's very interesting. It was called The Union of South Africa and the World in the 1990s. It was a study that was done in the late 80s to show that it was one of these scenario planning things. Royal Dutch Shell folks were involved. Bruce Scott at Harvard was involved. And there's a small monograph that describes that. And it's the monograph that was taken around South Africa to the business communities, to all the communities in South Africa that led to apartheid being eliminated. It predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall before it happened. It predicted that Japan, although it was on the rise, would diminish, and that Korea would come along. And they looked at economies from the Babylonian period until the present day. And they said there were a lot of different things for advantage, like innovation, like natural resources, like where they were positioned in the world. But there was only one factor that was common to every single country that became a leader, and it was the education of the common man. And it wasn't just the education of the elite. Now, while I think TJ is a great school and doing a lot for us, we have 70% of our students that don't graduate from high school. This is one of the lowest rates in the OECD. And until we can address that question, I think we're going to have a tough time. And I'd like to ask what's going on in that area.
Well, that was not a short question, nor is it one that will be satisfied with a short answer. But would anybody from the panel like to give it a first shot?
Just do something. I mean, I think, yeah. Ross, you and I talked a little bit earlier. We sometimes see the enormity of the problem, and it's too big to address. And I think you just do something, and over time, solutions can be constructed.
Yeah, I agree with that. And that's the reason why I think some of these state efforts are going to be very successful. And it's because they're at the grassroots. And the point is that if the problem can be small enough there that people can get their arms around it, and you can make the argument that it's necessary to do. So it's going to be an interesting issue as to how we attack that. But there's no question that what you've said is correct. Let me just make one comment before we close, if I might, and then I'm going to turn it over to our CSIS friends. First of all, again, our thanks for you all providing this venue for us today, because it's been a really great audience. And I really would like to thank the panel again for being willing to spend their morning here today and with some thoughtful background I think you heard. Secondly, I would also like to thank the ASTRA staff. Bob Berger is here, and Kurt Kerwitt, and I can assure you that this program would not have happened without them, because I just get to sit up here and they do the work. And I would say just one word, make one little speech with respect to ASTRA. This is a group, we are an advocacy group for primarily the proper attention by the federal government to basic research federal research in the physical sciences, the mathematical sciences, which includes computer science, and engineering. Because this is a segment of the research agenda which has been really pretty well neglected over the last 15 years or so. And if I look at the industry as a whole, about 75% of the industry is based in that milieu as their background. We've done reasonably well with the health things, except that we're now essentially eroding that because we passed the doubling of NIH, and now what we're doing is not even giving them inflationary increases, which I think is kind of silly to have given them the increase, and then you don't at least let them stay even is not a very sound way to do business. So any of you that have ideas about how we can best do this advocacy role, why, we are happy to have volunteers and all kinds of help, because we run a pretty shoestring operation, but so far we've been able to do some things that we think.
Sorry.
and we are part of the Alliance for Innovation here, and we've helped get that, and that has been a major push. They've been extremely useful in getting the Competes Act completed, I think. And one of the things we try to do is to be sure that we involve the industry and the universities and the scientific societies together, because it turns out we're not going to get the kind of attention if we do any one of those three by themselves. So our whole issue is to try to keep these three sectors all on the same page, moving in the same direction, and we have a lot of clout if we can do that. So thanks again for all the audience, thanks for the staff, and particularly thank this group of panelists. I think hopefully you felt it was worth your time this morning.
I think we're done. We'll have information up on our website, the slides and everything. This was a great panel. I'm not going to repeat it. I think Pat Wrightson said it, that it's fun to have one with substance. So thank you very much for coming.